Next stop, Tucum Carry. Thanks for traveling by Paul Yall.
Despite herself, Christy smiled.
You're a funny little man, Rail Ghost.
You don't know the half, Christy Roth.
Paul's eccentricities could be exasperating or unnerving, but sometimes they were sweet and funny. She turned her head and looked. So cheerful had Paul sounded that she was almost disappointed to see that Tucum Carry was just another small town that had been burned out and fallen down ages ago. Paul said no bombs had fallen nearby, but somebody, maybe even the inhabitants, had thoroughly trashed the ville in a more personal, one-on-one sort of way. She had to look back again quickly because her stomach got queasy. She was unused to riding backward like this, less still used to pedaling in that position. For its lack of size, the craft called the Paul Yall contained many surprises. The first had come when they set forth from the half-ruined shed the morning after their first encounter. The wind was blowing briskly from the north-northeast. Paul had unstrapped objects from beneath the platform and assembled them into masts and a triangular sail. He had then unfolded from the platform a second seat at the front end, identical to his own, for her to sit in as they traveled. That had been the point at which he had, mostly, accepted that Paul had told the truth when he explained why he was willing to help her follow Magog. That he had been a hermit for years, and now badly wanted someone just to talk to. She sensed that there was more to it than that, but after even the briefest acquaintance, she just found it impossible to believe he harbored any sinister intent. The next surprise had come when the wind veered in early afternoon as they were crossing a trestle bridge over a sandy wash that was too broad and flat to be called an arroyo. The sail emptied and they lost way. Paul had pedaled them to the far side, then got out, took down the sail, unstepped the mast, and stowed them back away. Then he unfolded a second set of pedals and gears mounted by Christie's seat and rigged a drive chain to a complicated mechanism below the platform itself. That translated the motion of the passengers pedaling into backward impetus. It had also been a surprise to Christy how sore her legs got so quickly. She assumed she was in rugged good shape from the fact she had walked thousands of miles and could run as long as necessary. It turned out that pedaling made use of a different set of muscles. Paul had veered erratically between sympathy and badly concealed amusement. He had been genuinely impressed when she whipped up a poultice of herbs she found when they sheltered for the night in an abandoned farmhouse near the tracks that soothed the ache in her muscles enough to let her sleep. The most recent surprise the Yall had contained was when approaching the mountains east of the Grandee. When the going got too much even for Paul's work-hardened muscles, he had produced a little two-stroke gasoline engine and attached that to the drivetrain. It had propelled them up and over the pass at a slow but steady speed. It was better than trying to make the journey by muscle power, but Christy found herself having to fight impatience and the ever-looming dread that she would never catch the fleet, fusion-powered monstrosity of a train. Today had been mostly pedaling against a mild headwind and occasional coasting on downhill grades. Her muscles were still sore, but she was quickly getting in shape. Her own Gaia-given self-healing gifts were helping. They began to pass the ruins of old Tucum Carry.
It seems strange somehow. It's like part of another world.
She had never felt the same detachment traveling the roads, even by Wag. Paul nodded.
It might as well be. It's a world that's forgotten the rails. It was already happening long ago, long before the big war.
Don't people notice when they see you riding along them?
Not so many do. It's not for nothing they call me the Rail Ghost. And besides, once I'm gone, I'm gone. And it's as if I never was. Was I real or just a mirage? People aren't used to thinking about the rails, or noticing the rails. So when they see someone like me riding on the rails, well, it just doesn't fit with what they thought all their lives. So they put me out of their minds as soon as they can. Kind of like digging a goat head out of your foot. It's forgotten as soon as you can't feel it anymore. You just walk on.
What if they see Magog? That's a little large to just put out of your head.
Huh. Well, that's a question there, Missy. It is indeed.
They passed the ruins and approached the new ville. The two tall T-shapes that had been apparent at a distance resolved themselves into crosses, carrying grisly, twisted burdens. Crows and ravens swarmed about the corpses.
Is this a good idea, Paul?
Since Tucum Carry was a rail junction, Their intention was to stop and ask the townsfolk which way Magog had gone, and if the occupants had let slip a hint as to final destination.
Hard as it may be to believe, even a baron could be wronged. And I reckon most folks will do all they can to pay back a slight. Just happens baron's got more wherewithal to do it.
He squinted up at the crucified shapes.
Got sick man boy haircuts. Baron Mike's pretty easygoing, baron or not. Wouldn't be easy to piss him off this much. Looks to me like this is on your pal, the general.
Something else he has to answer for.
Maybe so. Just as like they had it coming. And these parts, Missy, the wonder is how bad things manage to happen to them as don't deserve it, given the statistical unlikelihood of it and all, if you catch my meaning.
Nobody. Ryan, those women and children, nobody deserves... Oh, fuck it.
Arguing with Paul, she had learned already, was like trying to reason Doc out of one of his fugues. Paul took pressure off the pedals and began to spin down, backing off the intense exertion gradually so as to minimize the risk of cramps.
Yeah, we're about to find out one way or t'other. This here's our stop.
Following his example, slowing her own pedaling gradually so that she stayed just short of pushing, Christy frowned at the ville. It was generally well kept, which argued for a relative measure of prosperity, which in turn argued for relative peace. At the same time, while the land surrounding was slightly greener and more thickly vegetated than the desert farther west, her experienced eye saw signs they were heading into the true Deathlands. For example, the way all the roofs in sight were kept studiously intact, even if they consisted mostly of ad hoc patching, and the way every window had some kind of covering, if not glass, then a hinged shutter of gray-weathered plywood. They got chemstorms here. Fortunately, the sky showed no threat of one, and even the odd glimpse of blue here and there. So it struck her as odd that there was nobody out and about, and all the shutters were down. This was early spring in the High Plains, and midday heat not yet an issue.
Where is everybody?
Paul unfolded himself from his seat and stretched, then smoothed down his coat. He pulled off the goggles he wore to spare his eyes from windburn and bug strikes and stuffed them in a pocket. In their place, he put his heavy framed glasses with the taped bridge.
Dunno. Let's head on down and find out.
The embankment here was low, just enough to allow for drainage when it rained. He stepped down to level ground. Christy followed, long blaster unlimbered. She didn't like this setup a bit. If carrying the M16 openly made the locals nervous, too bad for them. If they didn't understand caution, they were triple stoop. The new ville had been laid down without apparent regard for the tracks, nor for their separation, which lay a couple hundred yards beyond the last hut of the settlement proper. It seemed more to have nucleated around the Baron's mansion a few blocks away, with the tracks forming a southern boundary of sorts, although a few structures lay outside it. They made their way between the buildings, Christy wary, Paul all but skipping, giddy with the adventure, or maybe the prospect of additional human contact. Just before reaching the mansion, Paul stopped to stoop and peer intently at a patch of adobe wall.
Huh. Will you look at that?
Christy glanced over his shoulder. She couldn't see anything but some scratches in the mud coating that might have been fresh and might have been some kind of symbol, or just random scrapes.
Oh, well.
Paul straightened again. He covered the open ground in front of the mansion in several swinging strides, trotted up the porch steps, and rapped on the door before Christy could suggest he might hold off for a bit so she could at least do a little reconnoitering. It wasn't going to do to greet the Baron blaster in hand. Angrily, she slung the M16. The door opened. A stout woman in a flowered apron, her gray hair piled in a bun, stood blinking through a pair of round-lensed spectacles at them.
May I help you?
Though it was a cool day, and likely cooler inside, Christy saw a fine sweat beading around the woman's hairline.
Good morning, ma'am. We've come to see Baron Mike.
She glanced back over her shoulder. Then she looked back at them and smiled.
Of course. Come in. I'll take you to him.
Baron Mike doesn't stand much on ceremony.
Huh.
They stepped into the gloom of the foyer.
What's that smell?
Right ahead of them was the foot of the stairs. The polished wood globe on the banister's end pedestal was covered with a dark stain that suggested dried blood. That might account for the undertone of stench. What accounted for the dried blood was another question. The woman led them to the left, back through a kind of parlor. In front of them, a curtain that seemed to be made out of a comforter with incongruous marine life, angelfish, seahorses printed on it in bright colors, covered a round-topped doorway. The housekeeper stopped and waved them on with quick, nervous gestures. Paul cruised right on through. Christy followed him tight. All her internal alarms were going off at once.
Shit.
Christy began to unsling her rifle. Paul had stopped short on the other side.
That doesn't seem to half cover it.
It had been a dining room. There was a huge, sturdy oval table in the middle of it. On the table lay the nude body of a man. He was pretty portly and probably middle-aged. It was impossible to tell for sure because the parts of him that hadn't been cut off or opened were covered in blood. One blue eye stared out of red tracery at the chandelier hanging from the high ceiling above. Christy realized her feet were sticking to the floor. Blood was congealing everywhere. The charnel house stench was gagging.
Fuck me. Ugh.
She brought her rifle around.
Ah!
A hand covered in weeping sores grabbed its flash suppressor from her left and wrenched the weapon out of her hands. She pivoted on her left leg, ramming her right up into the scabby's balls. All the breath exploded out of his body. He folded like a bad poker hand all the way to the floor. Christy was preparing to stop him good and proper when strong, stinking arms wrapped around her from behind.
No, Gaia, damn it!
She shifted her hips left, then rammed her right elbow straight back, pushing hard with left hand folded over right fist for emphasis. The new mutie lost his lungful and doubled over. She whipped both arms up in front of her, completing her breakaway, and turned clockwise into him. He had withered skin and a nose like a brown, cancerous carrot. She smashed a forward elbow slam into the side of his face. That stood him up again, opening him for an uppercut into the stomach, delivered with a Widdershins twist of the hips that lifted his sneakers out of the blood muck. He fell. Even as she started to turn back to her first assailant, he came at her again from behind, dropping the M16, held by buttstock and barrel, right over her head, pinning her arms to her sides. The mutie with a rotten carrot nose wrapped her ankles in his arms and clung to her like a baby possum. She was immobilized.
Paul, for fuck's sake, help me!
Paul just stood there between her and the table, shoulders hunched, staring at her with moist cow eyes.
Don't hurt her.
What?
Ho says he's been cheated once already. Ho says he wants woman unharmed.
Two figures had appeared through the kitchen door on the far side of the table with its gory burden. The voice was coming from a weird round mutie who had to crane his head to see past the ex-baron's split-open paunch. He scarcely came to the waist of the monstrous figure with a fistula for a face that stood behind him. Christy struggled futilely against the scabby's grip.
You're so lucky, hole-like. You're better than black hair, Cunny. Hole never had red furred coos before.
The little mutie rubbed claw-like hands.
Excuse me, neither.
The giant mutie bubbled excitedly through the hole in his face. Words could have been no clearer. A huge, misshapen hand began to knead a growing stiffness below the sack-like black garment.
No.
Christy ground her teeth in frustration. She would soon have to summon the power of Gaia to enter her body and increase her strength to superhuman levels. It took a horrific toll on her, risked incapacitating her. But she wouldn't allow herself to be violated by this monster with the oozing gap for a face.
Get ready!
Something thumped on the floor of the kitchen right behind Hole and rolled forward, almost between his boots. The giant and his rotund interpreter ignored it.
Hole give you plenty what a woman really wants.
A shimmer, like shockwaves made visible, passed upward and outward over Hole and skis, radiating in semicircles from the floor. Hole's vast booted feet seemed to have shrunk to a cone point, as if he were being transformed into a giant blacktop. He raised his tree trunk arms over his head. His hands were great claws of intolerable agony. Skeez's eyes bulged, as the distortion waves emanating from the floor seemed to intensify, as if the air itself were somehow becoming solid. His squat little body began to distort, to be drawn back and down toward the point from which the waves originated. Hole was half swallowed, arms flailing now, screaming as if he had no need to inhale.
What's happening?
Skeez's body seemed to shred and be sucked toward the point in rags of black and red.
his larger eyeball stretched and distorted into a banana shape before it popped like a water balloon.
Implogrin?
They were as rare as their effects were horrible. She'd seen them before. The comforter over the door whipped the legs of the scabby who held her pinned as air whistled toward the tiny singularity created by the grin. Watching his leader's unimaginable painful demise in horrified incomprehension, the scabby had slackened his grip. Christy managed to grab the M16 with both hands and pull down hard as she whipped her upper body forward and down. The scabby went flying, leaving the long blaster in her hands, and cartwheeled over the late unzipped Baron Mike into the Gren's distortion ripples, which were already subsiding. His very atoms were stripped from one another and sucked in a maelstrom right out of this world. The moldy mutie on the floor had also lost his grip on the red-headed woman. She kicked a boot backward to free it up, then snapped it forward as if to launch all the terror and fury that filled her right out of her silver-chased toe. The mutie's neck snapped like kindling.